popular historian and best-selling author Kenneth C. Davis. Kenneth C. Davis is best known for his more than two dozen Don't Know Much About History books, but has written several other history books as well. His subjects range from the Pilgrims to presidents, slavery to the Spanish flu. He's a popular guest on Maine Calling, so we have invited him back for this special program during our Grow Together Fall Membership Drive. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll talk with Ken about current events and how they fit into the story of our country. We'll also check in with Maine Public Chief Political Reporter Steve Missler, who will give us an update on the 2nd District Congressional race and the challenge to ranked choice voting. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yesterday, the nation and world commemorated the end of World War I. Last week, voters went to the polls in historic numbers. Today, we are going to hear from a favorite Maine Calling author and historian who will put recent events into context. On the line with us from the studios of NPR in New York City, Kenneth C. Davis, the best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. He's also the acclaimed author of In the Shadow of Liberty. And his most recent book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Hi, Kenneth. Thanks for joining us.
It is always a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What moments in American history are you thinking about right now? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Before we go back to Ken, though, Steve Missler is on the line with us to give us an update on the ballot counting in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Steve is Maine Public's chief political correspondent. Steve, I understand this is an unfolding story. As of this morning, we knew that there was the 2nd Congressional District's race had triggered the ranked choice voting. But now, a few hours later, everything has changed.
Well, the voting has continued, Jennifer. The tabulation of the ranked choice voting has continued. The state officials are doing that. They've been doing that since Friday. And with an eye towards potentially running the tabulation results tomorrow, being Wednesday. What's happened in the interim, though, which is developing, is that Bruce Poliquin, who's the Republican incumbent in the race, has filed a lawsuit basically seeking an injunction of ranked choice voting of the law that voters approved 2 years ago that's being used for the very first time in a congressional race right now. And he's filed a lawsuit in federal court in Bangor seeking to basically stop that process. And they've filed basically six claims challenging the constitutionality of that law.
And does he have a strong argument? I understand that courts have argued in favor of the ranked choice voting law up until this point.
Well, he's made a bunch of different claims, Jennifer, that some may be looked favorably upon by the court, perhaps. One of them is what's known as the Equal Protection Clause, which they basically argue, Poliquin's attorneys are basically arguing that, you know, that voters who just pick one candidate in a ranked choice voting election have less say in the outcome than voters who select or rank several others. Now, the counter to that claim is that everybody has a chance to rank a candidate. And so this issue was actually brought up in Maine Supreme Court earlier this year by Judge Alexander, and it was sort of squashed by Lee Sofley, who's the Chief Justice, because it wasn't really pertinent at the time. But now Poliquin's attorneys are trying to make it front and center of an assortment of claims in this particular case. The other issue here is whether or not it's too late to file this kind of a challenge. I mean, everybody has expected ranked choice voting for months now, and to come in and try to change the rules after voters have used it is something I expect that attorneys will on the other side defending the law will obviously contest.
So at this point, there has not been the injunction. The counting goes on. What do you expect to happen next?
Well, I think what will happen, Jen, is that Poliquin's attorneys may seek a temporary restraining order by the end of the day. I mean, the Secretary of State's office has said that they're going to continue to do the tabulation and count ballots. They are not going to stop doing that unless the courts tell them to. And so the courts, I think Poliquin's attorneys are going to seek that injunction, or excuse me, a temporary restraining order, perhaps by the close of business today. And we'll see whether or not they win in that case, win in that motion. It's tough to say because no judge has responded to any of this, and there hasn't even been a chance by defendants in the case, in this case, the Secretary of State's office, to respond to it.
And Steve, before we let you go, let me ask you this. You talked about the Maine Supreme Court, the challenge to ranked choice voting that came in Maine Supreme Court. Has a challenge to ranked choice voting come before any federal court up to this point?
No, not in Maine, but there was a case in San Francisco that did reach the district court there, the Ninth Circuit, that looked precisely at one of the claims made here, which is the equal protection claim, and that was defeated. There was the court there basically said that, you know, all voters have a chance to rank, and it's up to them to make that decision, and that it is not a violation of the equal protection clause.
Well, thanks so much for taking some time, Steve. I know that a lot of things are unfolding today. We look forward to your reporting later today. Steve Missler, Maine Public's senior political correspondent. Back to historian Kenneth C. Davis. Kenneth, I want to thank you again for joining us, especially today. This is the first day of a fall membership drive here, and so it's so important to us to have such a great guest as you today.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you. And as I was telling you off air, I just picked up a button in the NPR office out here in New York that says I'm a public radio nerd, and I will wear that button proudly. And I hope everyone who's listening understands the value of public radio and that it is listener supported. So please do your part.
We
won't have a Liberty Loan drive because and I'll explain that in a minute. 100 years ago, Liberty Loan drives were meant to pay for the war effort, and in Philadelphia in particular, they led to some drastic and ghastly results because 200,000 people went out to march in a Liberty Loan drive, and 3 days later, every hospital bed in Philadelphia was full.
Because people had the flu.
With the Spanish influenza, yes.
Mm. Well, you know, we were just talking with Steve Missler, our chief political correspondent, about the election that has not ended here in Maine in our second congressional district. But I just want to think back over the past week with you and your historical perspective. As you watched the results come in after Election Day over the past few days, and you saw the large number of women of people who have non-traditional backgrounds, people who are Muslim, people of color, be elected to the United States Congress. What did you think?
Well, I think that I was pleasantly surprised, as many people were, at this outcome because it reflected much more what the country is increasingly looking like. And there's been, to be honest, I believe, a concerted effort on the part, particularly of the Republican Party in many states, to limit those people who look like that from voting. So I think very much so that democracy was on the ballot last week. And I have to tell you something very poignant that happened to me the night before Election Day. I'm actually taking a college class with much younger people. And most of the other kids in the class were young people of color or Latinas. And they weren't either registered or they weren't going to vote. And one of them said to me, oh, what does it matter? My vote won't count because of that electoral college. And I sort of, at the insistence of my professor, I'm not the professor, I'm a student, launched into an impromptu explanation of how the system works. And it was clear that a lot of these kids did not understand what the election meant, what the vote means. And so we have to do a much better job in this country of explaining democracy and certainly simplifying the process. I know what Maine is going through right now. We won't go into the benefits or not of ranked choice, but we are experimenting all around the country with ways to get more people involved and to make this a fairer process. We are now 231 years after constitutional democracy was born in Philadelphia, drafted in 1787 in the summertime. It is a work in progress and continues to be. And I think that one of the clear things was that democracy was on the ballot last week. Florida allowed former felons to vote, and that's an extraordinary step that I hope will be replicated in other places around the country. And so we are trying to expand our democracy, even at a time when it's been restricted in many places, but also people are still a little bit too disinterested in the process, and that is a civic danger that we must all confront.
Kenneth, a lot was made leading up into the election and the time since about how there's historical precedent for whatever president is in power to lose seats in Congress. Was what we saw last week just part of the what seems to be natural political cycle, or was it something else?
I think I'd have to be honest and say it was something else, even though it has historically has happened for the most part, with the exception primarily of wartime midterms. They usually do not affect the president's party as much as other midterms do. But there have been major swings throughout history in midterm elections going back very far, but certainly many of them since the 1980s and the 1970s, going back to the Nixon Watergate class, where a huge Democratic wave of congressmen came in after Nixon's election in 1972. In the midterm of 74, I guess it was, there was a huge shift in the Congress. So we've seen this before. This one, as the results keep changing, and you know, there was a lot of instant analysis last week, and that's always a dangerous thing. It's great to be a historian because you can usually wait to talk about these things a little bit, and sometimes you get to wait to talk about them 100 years later. But with a week's distance from that election and the change in some of the outcomes around the country, and of course, still undecided, major undecided elections in Florida, in Georgia. Arizona was settled yesterday with the election of a Democrat for the first time in decades to the Senate. So I think that this was a kind of sea change election. It was a sea change in terms of the number of young people who went out and voted, the number of African Americans who seemed to vote in much larger numbers, particularly in a midterm. And, you know, we thought in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama that we had entered a new phase in American politics. That was overly optimistic. We reverted to some norms. And I think that this election proved that motivated voters all across the country can really make a difference.
The control of the House by Democrats has raised the possibility of impeachment proceedings. Ken, without excuse me, without discussing the merits of what's going on today, why don't you fill us in on the history of impeachment? What is an impeachable offense and how does it work?
Well, it's we wish we had a perfect dictionary definition of it, but Gerald Ford may have given the best definition when he was this the House majority. Was a House Republican leader, but not the majority leader, back in the 1970s before he became the vice president and later the president due to the resignation of Richard Nixon. Ford said at the time that an impeachable offense is what a majority of the House of the House of Representatives thinks it is. And that's a really important political definition that applies. The Constitution refers to high crimes, treason, bribery, high crimes and other misdemeanors. So that covers a multitude of sins, of course, and it is really left up to a majority of the House of Republicans to impeach a president or another federal officer. Most of the 19 impeachments in American history have been of justices. Judges at different levels, including the very first one was of a Supreme Court justice. So this is a long history, but not a great history, of very, very usually partisan decision-making. And I should then go on to note that only two presidents have been impeached to date. Impeachment, of course, is the equivalent in the criminal world of an indictment. It doesn't mean guilt. It means you then go to a trial. The trial in this case would be done by the Senate, and the impeached president gets to put on a defense, and witnesses can be called, and the Supreme Court Chief Justice oversees this process. But of course, with two presidential impeachments in our history, first Andrew Johnson, Abraham Lincoln's successor, and then Bill Clinton, we have never convicted a president who has been impeached. So it's a high bar that the Constitution framers built into the Constitution a long time ago. They took it very seriously that the president was elected by the people and shouldn't just be removed by fiat or out of political necessity or out of just not liking the guy. But as Benjamin Franklin put it back then, if we didn't have a way to remove a president or an official legally, the only resort would be assassination.
We're talking with best-selling author and historian Kenneth C. Davis. If you'd like to join the conversation, this is a different phone number than the membership phone number. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566 to ask a question of historian Kenneth C. Davis. When we come back from this break, we're going to ask you, Kenneth, about a couple different things. We're going to ask about World War I, we're going to ask about Thanksgiving, and I want to hear about the book you're working on. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, uncovering interesting facts about our nation's history, especially in relation to current events. Joining me today, the best-selling author Kenneth C. Davis. You know him from his Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His most recent book is More Deadly Than War: The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu in the First World War. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Kenneth C. Davis, I know that you were probably like many people watching your television set this past weekend, watching some of the wonderful ceremonies marking the 100th anniversary of the armistice of World War I. What were you thinking as you watched these?
Well, beyond watch, I actually attended a service in our neighborhood here in New York City. A small church had decided to get together and figure out who had actually died from the neighborhood in the war. So it was a really moving mass that included Fauré's Requiem being sung by the choir, and then the reading of 200 names. Mm. Of local men from the West Village of New York City, this is a fairly circumscribed neighborhood, who had died in the war. There is in this neighborhood, in fact, a statue of the Doughboy that was constructed in 1921. The Doughboy was what they called young American soldiers who'd gone over to fight in the war. The phrase, and I explained in More Deadly Than War, has many, many suspected derivations, but it's a very old one, and it doesn't just connect to donuts, although that seemed to really confirm the make it permanent, that these were the doughboys and the Salvation Army nurses who came to feed them were giving them fried dough, and so they became doughnuts and doughboys, got linked even more so. But the doughboy statue is in our neighborhood, and when it was dedicated in 1921, 20,000 New Yorkers came out to this. So this is 100 years ago. It was somewhat removed for a lot of us, particularly people of my generation whose fathers fought in World War II. That was the Great War, the big war. And so the distant World War I seemed remote. But I don't think there's a better case, a better example of how history connects past to present than the 100-year story of World War I and what it meant. First of all, the immediate after effects, the Versailles Treaty of 1919. When it was signed, the Prime Minister of England at the time said there'll be another war in 25 years. He was right about the other war. He was off by 5 years because, of course, it was from 1919 to 1939 when Germany invades Poland, that World War I begins September 1st, 1939. So there's a direct connection, of course, between what happened in Versailles in 1919 and the roots of World War II. But you can look at almost any hotspot around the world in the past decade or so and draw a line back to 1919 and the Treaty of Versailles. A place called Mesopotamia was divided up into nations that we now know as Iran and Iraq and others. The nation of Yugoslavia was created since torn back apart after a bloody wars of the 90s. So almost all of these hotspots around the world can be traced back to the decisions that were made in the wake of World War I, and that's one of the most important reasons to understand it. But there's another thing, and we've heard about it a great deal in the past week, especially after the French president spoke on Sunday and mentioned the word nationalism, specifically saying nationalism was not patriotism. This is a word that has a new connotation in this country, but nationalism and the intense nationalism that was taking place in Europe in 1914 and the military buildups that went along with it are part of the reason that this terrible, terrible war came. And when it started in August 1914, the Kaiser of Germany, the Tsar of Russia, the King of England, they were cousins. They were all descended from Queen Victoria. They had been at her funeral together a few years earlier. In fact, the year before, most of them had been in Berlin for the royal wedding of the Kaiser's daughter. A year later, they are at war. The Kaiser says the troops will be home before the leaves turn. The King of England says the troops will be home by Christmas time. By the end of 1918, just a few months after the war started, 1 million men had died. It was an extraordinary period in history where men went off to battle dressed as if they were in the Napoleonic Wars on horseback, but they were going to be confronting 20th century warfare, battleships, tanks, barbed wire, artillery, machine guns, hand grenades, and gas, all of these things, and the airplane as well. So this was an extraordinary moment in history and one that reverberates down to us today, and we still have to think about what this word nationalism means.
You mentioned that these leaders were all related in your book about the Spanish flu. There's a remarkable photograph, and they all look exactly alike, don't they?
Well, they look alike in part because of their military wear, but they certainly have a familial resemblance. But this is family feud gone really, really wrong, and I don't mean to be glib about that. But they was this sense that this was a family argument. That if Queen Victoria, who was a powerful personality, had still been alive, there's a suggestion that she would have kept them in line and possibly prevented all this. But that ignores the fact that this was not really just a war about territory in France and Belgium. It was really a war to control the resources of the world because the world had moved into the 20th century. Oil was becoming more significant, so was rubber. These were things that were found in other parts of the world, and the race to control and build new colonial empires was really driving this war in 1914.
We'll go to Judy, who's calling from Rockport. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Regarding history and civics and our knowledge of either, both, I was appalled the other, I guess it was last week, there was a program regarding the Great Lakes. And it really brought home the abhorrent history lessons that I received at very good schools, in elementary, high school, and even college level courses. The only thing we were required to learn about the Great Lakes was their names, and that was fine. And that was even then. It wasn't even teaching to test at that time. History is extremely personal, as is civics. And I wonder what it will take to get the education systems to truly incorporate this engaging, important, very highly personal material.
Judy, I think that you're speaking Ken's language, because Ken, there's nothing more important to you, is there, than teaching young people the
Absolutely.
Real lessons of history and civics.
Absolutely. We could do an hour on this subject, I'm sure, if not more, Jennifer. And thank you for the call, Judy. First of all, one thing I've learned in 30 years of doing this, since Don't Know Much About History first came out and became a substantial success, it proved that people don't hate history. They just hate the dull version they got back in high school. Now, we do a terrible job of teaching history because we generally reduce it to dates, battles, and speeches to be memorized for a standardized test and then quickly forgotten. History is the story of real people doing real things, and when we teach it that way, it becomes alive, meaningful, and then we are able to connect past to present, which is the reason we should be teaching history in the first place. Now, I've found, especially in recent years, that history teachers, social studies teachers, civics teachers in this country are absolutely dedicated to this idea. They have missionary zeal for wanting to get their students involved and interested and encourage them. They're often up against a system that doesn't really help them or support them. Textbooks are miserable, they're out of date, they're often 25 years old, they're boring. The schools often require history teachers to help out with test preparation, so they take time away from the class. We don't spend enough time requiring history. So there's a whole host of ills about this, but I'm not going to put it on the teachers, because the ones I have spoken to, including fairly recently, the Maine Council for Social Studies, where I spoke about a year ago, they're desperately eager to make this stuff alive and meaningful for their students. And I think it shows when you see what's happened in this country in the past year or so, where we've had an extraordinary number of very young people, and I'm pointing specifically to the Parkland kids who, in the wake of this terrible, terrible shooting in Florida, really began to stage a social across the country teach-in about elections and the importance of voting. So I really am encouraged in a way that the young people in some respects are leading the way on this one, and I think that they in part have been well taught.
We're speaking with historian and best-selling author Kenneth C. Davis. We'll talk about Thanksgiving when we come back, but first, back to Susan and Charles. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a favorite Maine Calling guest, Kenneth C. Davis, the best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Ken, what are you going to have for Thanksgiving dinner?
Well, this is an unusual Thanksgiving for us because our children are both far away from us this year. So we are going to take a long-deferred trip to Rome. And we'll be in Rome on Thanksgiving, which also happens to be my wife's birthday. So I don't know how the Romans do turkey, but I wish they would call it tacchino. So we'll see. It might be something entirely different, but a very different Thanksgiving experience for me. I'm actually usually working on Thanksgiving, both talking to people on the radio about the history of Thanksgiving and then generally usually cooking it too. So this is a novel experience.
Well, this is funny because the reason I asked is I thought that perhaps you might be eating something other than turkey because you know about the real first Thanksgiving.
That's
and you
correct.
Know that the pilgrims did not eat turkey. What are some of the myths associated with Thanksgiving that you would like to let us know about?
Well, I've been writing and talking about this for as long as I've been doing history because it is a perfect example of how we tend to learn a legendary version, a mythic even version in this case, because a myth is a sacred story and the story of the pilgrims is our American sacred story, except that it's so riddled with inaccuracies and oversights and omissions, in some case grievous ones. Of course, first of all, we should point out, as I've written before and we've probably spoken about before, the first pilgrims in America were French, and they landed in Florida 50 years before the Mayflower landed. They were then wiped out by the Spanish, who founded St. Augustine for exactly that purpose. And this was a story that was entirely left out of my school books, but I thought it was rather interesting that the real first pilgrims who came to America seeking religious freedom from the wars of religion in France were put to death in a religious massacre, an appropriate way to begin a different version of American history. Of course, the pilgrims who arrive on the Mayflower, only about half of them are what we would call pilgrims, those people coming in search of their own religious freedom. The other half were called strangers by the passengers on the Mayflower, about 100 passengers. And of course, only about half of those 100 survived that first winter and were even alive in probably, and we don't know the exact date, October of 1621 for what became the first Thanksgiving feast, celebrated, by the way, over the course of 3 days. You might think your dinner lasts a little too long. They went at it for 3 days. The Wampanoag went out, and unexpected and uninvited guests brought back 5 deer, so there was certainly venison. There was a lot of fresh seafood because there they were on the shores of the Cape and enjoying all the fresh seafood they could possibly get. And of course, one of those famous Native Americans who came to welcome them and walked into camp one day and said hello to them in English, they half naked and somewhat starving, was a man whose name is pretty famous in Maine. His name is Samoset, and he probably came from Monhegan Island. So Maine has a true connection to the first Thanksgiving.
We'll go to Richard, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
There. I heard mention of the Spanish flu in World War I, and I have been enjoying learning more about history by looking at my ancestors and their siblings and families. And I stumbled upon my great-grandfather's brother who died in World War I. I always thought he died on the in the trenches of France, and I've recently learned, and this was not known in the family, I recently learned he was drafted on August 27, 1918, and on October 9th, he died of the flu at Fort Devens, or Camp Devens, as it was called, and I was reading about that, and I had never heard about thousands of soldiers dropping like flies due to the Spanish flu, and I'm wondering, why isn't that covered more in talking about that? You hear about it on the battlefield, but to happen at home, hundreds of miles from home, a month into being drafted, must have been horrible. And did they squelch that news to try to keep morale high?
Well, Richard, you know, Kenneth Davis wrote a whole book about this. I'd highly recommend it. It's written for young adults, so it's a quick and entertaining read. But Kenneth C. Davis, it's not that people squelched it as much as people just didn't want to talk about it, right?
That's what comes down to us, that people did not want to talk. Even people had deaths in the family. It was almost like, it was so terrible, we don't want to talk about it. And the nation did that. There was a collective amnesia, a collective forgetting. A couple of points to the call, and thank you very much for it. First of all, he mentioned the draft. Many people don't know that the draft was very, very much alive in 1917 because there weren't enough recruits. They didn't want to call it the draft, so they called it the Selective Service System. Doesn't that sound like a nice euphemism? Flu really began in America in March of 1918 in the bases where hundreds of thousands of young men were recruited or drafted into service. And it spread through the camps, and then those men got onto trains, crowded trains, and then onto crowded ships, and they went to France where the arrival of 1 million Americans, many of them infected with this virus, spread the flu across Europe. 100,000 approximately Americans die in World War I fighting. About 40 to 60,000 of them, more than half or about half, may have died from the flu. So the caller is exactly right. This number of Americans who died in the war, many died from the flu. The draft was actually canceled for 2 months in September and October of 1918 because the Army could not handle the numbers. And Camp Devens was one of the hottest of the hot spots. Four researchers were sent there to find out what was going on. One of them talks about how the bodies are stacked like cordwood, and that was a phrase repeated around the country. And one says, "I don't know what we're looking at here. This doesn't look like the flu. This might be a new plague." And by that, he really was talking about the Black Plague. And indeed, the Spanish flu, a misnomer, came to be the most deadly global pandemic in history since the Black Plague of medieval times. It's an extraordinary story, and the story of how it was written out of the history books is part of the story.
Well, Richard, thanks for your call. And that's going to be our last call, unfortunately. We could talk to you forever, Ken Davis. But looking forward to your new book. I can't wait to have you back. A tentative title, Strong Men, correct?
That's correct. And very much to the point, it's about how men take power and how their countries allow them to take power. And one of the most important things that these authoritarian, totalitarian dictators do to kill democracy is to kill the free press. And so very apropos of your pledge drive, one can opt for no public media or state-owned media. But public radio is a way to make sure that that there is not state-run media. And it's a very important idea as we all want to continue the ideas of democracy.
Well, Kenneth C. Davis, as always, a treat to have you on Maine Calling. He's the best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History series and his acclaimed book, In the Shadow of Liberty, his most recent book, More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. George Thomas ran the board today. Maine Calling's produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.